Lecture 2, The Religious World of Early Christianity.
In our previous lecture, we saw a wide range of fascinating topics that we'll be covering in this course on the history of early Christianity. As we saw there, in order to begin our study, we need to situate the rise of Christianity in its own historical context within the Greco-Roman world. The term Greco-Roman world refers to the lands around the Mediterranean from roughly the time of Alexander the Great, who died around the year 300 BC, to the time of the Emperor Constantine, who was ruling around the time of 300 AD. So from about 300 BC to 300 AD, the lands around the Mediterranean during this 600-year period. The period begins with Alexander the Great, who was one of the most important figures in the history of Western civilization. Arguably, the most important person. About 20 years ago now, there was a survey done of college professors who taught political science, history of Western civilization, history more broadly, philosophy, scholars of the liberal arts. The question asked of these scholars was, who is the most important person for the history of Western civilization? Now, when I ask my students this in my large undergraduate classes at Chapel Hill, they have an unambiguous response. The most important person for a history of civilization at all was Jesus, Jesus of Nazareth. They're a bit taken aback when I tell them that Jesus, in fact, in this particular survey, tied for fifth, tied with the Apostle Paul, fifth place, for as it came out from the survey, a number of scholars thought that these two were the co-founders of Christianity. Well, who was number one if Jesus tied for fifth? In fact, Alexander the Great. According to these scholars, there's no way of gauging whether they're right or wrong, but in their opinion, Alexander the Great was the most important person for the history of Western civilization because without him, Western civilization would not have happened. Why is that? Alexander the Great, known sometimes as Alexander of Macedon, was a great military genius who conquered most of the Mediterranean lands from his native land, Macedonia, in the east, where we think of as Greece today. He started conquering Macedonia. He then actually conquered Greece to the south. And he conquered the lands around the Mediterranean, including Egypt, Palestine, and Persia. But it wasn't simply that he was a conqueror that made him important. He's important for the history of the West because of what happened in the wake of his conquests. Alexander was enamored with Greek culture and civilization. He had been a student, a pupil of the Greek philosopher Aristotle. And so when one thinks about genealogical lines, Socrates was the teacher of Plato, Plato was the teacher of Aristotle, and Aristotle was the teacher of Alexander. Now, unlike these other three, Alexander himself was not a philosopher, but he was enamored of Greek philosophical ways and culture, religion, and language. As he conquered lands around the Mediterranean, all the way east into the Persian Empire, all the way south into Egypt, he spread Greek culture among the places that he conquered. It became a very popular thing for the educated elite in this area to learn how to speak Greek and to adopt Greek ways, Greek customs, Greek religions. Cities were built following the Greek pattern, so that throughout this entire area, Greek became something that was known by the upper class elites who were in kind of competition with one another to show that they were more sophisticated, more urbane than their neighbors. Well, how would they demonstrate that? By showing that they were more Greek. In some ways, this land of the Mediterranean, especially the Eastern Mediterranean, then was unified under Greek culture in a way that it had never been unified in history. This culture brought a kind of unity to this area that had never been seen before, which allowed for all sorts of things, including travel, including shared cultural experiences, shared religions, and so forth. Alexander died as a very young man. He was born in the year 356 BC, died in the year 323 as a 33-year-old. He died. The kingdom that he had established by his conquests was then split up among various ones of his generals. And so there were different regions then, so that the empire itself broke up. But the Hellenistic culture, meaning the Greek culture that had started under Alexander, continued on for centuries. Eventually, the Romans conquered most of the lands that Alexander had previously conquered 200 years earlier. The Roman Empire eventually reached from Great Britain in the west to Syria in the east. It extended into both the southern and the northern Mediterranean. It included North Africa, Egypt, and Palestine. And so when I refer to the Greco-Roman world, I'm referring to this region around the Mediterranean from the time of Alexander up to the Roman Emperor Constantine. Christianity was born within this Greco-Roman world about its midpoint, with the birth of Jesus sometime probably around the year 4 BC. It's important for us to understand this birth of Christianity by situating it not simply within the Mediterranean at this time, but also within the context of religion in the Mediterranean at this time. And so we'll be devoting this lecture to the religion of the Greco-Roman world, specifically around the time of the birth of Christianity. The vast majority of persons living in the Roman Empire, as I pointed out in the previous lecture, were pagans, meaning that they were polytheists who adhered to various local and state religions, or as scholars usually call these religions, cults. This is another term that doesn't mean the same thing when scholars of antiquity use it as modern people use it. Today, when you speak of a cult, you usually think of some kind of marginalized fringe group that's on the edge of sanctioned religion. When historians refer to cults in the ancient world, they aren't referring to it in that sense. Cult simply comes from a Latin term, cultus deorum, which means the care of the gods. We have the same root in English when we say agriculture. That's the care of the fields. The cultus deorum is the care of the gods. Cults are simply forms of ritual worship. The vast majority of people in the empire then were polytheists, believing in many gods, who participated in one or another of the state and local cults, forms of worship. For people living in this ancient world at the time of Christianity's birth, pagans living in this world, the idea of worshiping many gods was seen to be both natural and obvious. In our world today, it seems natural and obvious that there either is a god or there's no god. Hardly anybody in our context thinks that it would be natural or obvious that there'd be many gods, but that's a different common sense from what you get in the ancient world. The ancient common sense was that there are many gods. There were virtually no atheists the way that we define the term today. Interestingly enough, as we'll see later in this course, Christians who were worshiping one god were called atheists by the pagans. They were atheists because they didn't worship the gods. And so one of the charges against Christianity is that they were the atheists. Things have changed quite drastically since those days. Ancient people knew that there were lots of gods for lots of places and lots of purposes. Every place had its god. Forests, rivers, streams, plains, fields, homes, places within the home, the hearth, the pantry, the entryway. All of these had gods who were in charge of these various areas. Gods were in charge of everything involving human life. There were gods in charge of the crops that grew, gods in charge of the weather, gods in charge of war, gods in charge of health, various gods for various purposes for different places. People in the ancient world would not understand what it meant. Most would not understand what it would mean to worship just one god. Why would you worship one god? For ancient pagans, that would be like saying you can have only one friend. Well, why can you have only one friend? There are a lot of people. Well, why can you only worship one god? There are lots of gods. Pagan worship then involved a polytheism that seemed natural and obvious. There were various kinds of gods. They included, of course, the great gods that we know about from Greek and Roman mythology. These great gods were known to the ancient people by stories told about them in the myths. Greek gods, for example, such as Zeus and Hera and Aphrodite, or the Roman gods who were their equivalents, so Jupiter and Juno and Venus and many other great gods. These are gods who were far beyond us, who, in fact, had very little to do with us here on Earth. Below the great gods, there were local gods, powerful deities who protected and cared for cities and towns and villages. There were even lesser gods who were localized in forests and rivers and roads. There were family gods who cared for the home. Lots of gods, lots of places of different degrees of power. These gods, as I've indicated, oversaw every human function and activity. They oversaw the crops, the cupboard, the hearth, personal health, childbirth, war, love, and everything else. The divine realm was seen, therefore, among most pagans as a kind of pyramidical structure, in which at the very top, many pagans thought there was one god who was the chief god, the head god, sometimes thought of as the one supreme being who was purely spirit, who was so far removed from us that we can't even imagine what he was like. Below him on this pyramid structure, then, are the great gods. Below these great gods in this pyramid are local deities and on down. Many pagans believed that that there were human beings who had a divine aspect to them. There were men who were sometimes called divine men, thought to have been born of the union of a mortal woman and a god. You get the stories in mythology of the gods, of a god, maybe Zeus, commonly Zeus, who looks down and sees a beautiful woman whom he can't resist, and he comes down in the shape of a human and has sexual intercourse with her, and the child then that is born is divine, but also human, half and half. Heracles, the god Hercules, in fact, was one such god, who was actually half mortal, half immortal. As you know, in the Roman Empire, the Roman emperor himself was sometimes thought of as being divine. But it's important to understand that when Romans talked about the emperor being God, they didn't mean the one chief god or one of the great gods. They didn't think that he was Zeus or that he or one of these other gods. He was a divine man, somebody who's far beyond the rest of us in his power and in his abilities. How could he be so magnificent, so great? It's because, in fact, he was a divine being. He was a member of the divine realm, even though he was here as a human. And so this was the divine realm for most pagans, who were polytheists. Religion, for these people, was not a matter of securing the afterlife, the way it is for many people today. Where I live in North Carolina, I guess the part of North Carolina I live in is the buckle of the Bible Belt. I have students who come from this region, and most of my students are raised in very conservative Christian environments. And I would say, at least for these college students, the principal reason for being religious is to secure the afterlife. They either want to have a heavenly reward or they want to avoid a hellish payment in which they're forced to pay for their sins in the afterlife. Many of the people I associate with daily are religious, if they're religious, in order to secure the afterlife. That's not the case in the ancient world. In fact, religion was not a matter of securing an afterlife. Religion was a matter of honoring the gods who could protect and assist mortals now in the present because of their needs. People in the ancient world, of course, were living fairly close to the edge, as a rule, much more so than most of us are today. It was quite common for women to die in childbirth, for example, or for children to die as infants. In the Roman world at this time, in order to keep the population constant, every childbearing age woman had to have, on average, 5 children. In order to keep the population constant. A very different world from ours. This, of course, was a world in which there wasn't anything like modern medicine. One very common way of dying in the ancient world was by getting a tooth abscess. They had no way of fighting the infection. If somebody got a tooth abscess, they would quite often they would die from it. People can't control such things. They can't control the drought. They can't control illness. They can't control crop failure. If one season, you don't get sufficient rain. The next season, your village might die from starvation. The worship of the gods was intended to provide for humans that which they could not provide for themselves. The gods were more powerful than we. The gods were able to provide us what we need in order to thrive in this world. Rain, health, prosperity, love, and peace. One of the motivating factors in ancient religion was the fear of the gods. Gods did not actively involve themselves in human affairs very often or all the time, but gods were to be feared because they could bring calamity if things didn't go well between the humans and the divine in their cultic experiences. If the gods were not worshipped the way that they were supposed to be worshipped, then in fact their wrath could be manifest against humans. Earthquakes, volcanoes, hurricanes, famine, drought, disease, these are things that the gods can bring if they're not worshipped properly. Religion, therefore, sought the peace of the gods. This was a technical term in ancient religion, the pax deorum, the peace of the gods. If the gods are at peace, both among themselves and with people, then things will go well. And so you want to make sure that the gods are on your side. Religion is a way of making sure that that happens. The gods do not demand a lot, in fact. The gods do not demand exclusive devotion. The gods do not insist that you spend all of your time being concerned about them. But there were ritual practices that the gods had asked humans to follow. And when humans did this, then things went well. You maintained the peace of the gods. What are these ritual acts? Well, the gods were worshipped principally through acts of prayer and especially sacrifice of animals. Pagans had temples throughout their world, temples that were, some were majestic temples to the great gods, some were just small local temples. Even within a home, there might be a sanctuary, a place dedicated to a god. Sacrifices to gods were performed in the temples, in the sacred places that had been set up for the purpose. Often in local city religion, there would be a particular day set aside for a particular sacrifice, and this was a time of celebration for ancient pagans. Most people in the ancient world didn't eat meat very regularly. Meat would be eaten only during a time of a sacrifice. And so this would be a party time. Suppose a city had a particular god and they have a particular day in which they worship this particular god. They perform a sacrifice in the temple. You bring an animal to the temple. The priests sacrifice the animal. And then they don't destroy the animal. This is how you get your meat. They might burn some of the inedible portions. That'd be the portions for the god. But then they would cook the meat and have a party. Many of these temples, in fact, had dining rooms as parts of the temple, so that the priest would cook the meat. You'd have a party there and have friends, family over, and you would celebrate. We know about this because we found inscriptions on temples that gave rules about how to celebrate the sacrifice. And these rules include such things like telling you that only so much wine can be drunk at a particular meal, what to do in case rowdy behavior breaks out. These are things, in other words, it's pretty clear that these are festive, enjoyable occasions. Pagans worshiped them by saying prayers and performing acts of sacrifice. These were periodic affairs. Gods did not expect any kind of constant devotion, the way that Christians might think of the way they need to relate to the Christian God, but the sacrifice and prayers were done periodically. It may seem strange, but in fact it's the facts, that ethics were not, for the most part, a feature of ancient pagan religions. Pagan religions were not interested in ethical behavior of how you related to your neighbor, to your family, so much as they were concerned about how you worshiped the gods. It was philosophy in the ancient world rather than religion that was concerned about ethics. I'm not saying that pagans were unethical. In fact, pagans were about as ethical as people are today. But ethics was not a part of the religion. It was part of their philosophy, their ways of life. Nor, interestingly enough, for modern people, was correct doctrine an issue in ancient religion. Now, this seems very strange to many Christians for whom what you believe really matters. But in the ancient pagan religions, what you believed didn't matter. There were no creeds that were to be said. There was no heresy. There was no orthodoxy. These were not religions that were concerned with doctrine. They were religions that were concerned with sacrifices to the gods, following set principles and set rituals that had been developed over the years. Since doctrine was not important to these religions tended to be highly tolerant of one another, unlike what you might expect. People today might think of the Roman religions as being intolerant. After all, they persecuted the Christians, which is true. But by and large, these religions were highly tolerant of one another, largely because there was no idea that you had to have correct doctrine. Nobody thought that if you worshiped this particular god, you couldn't also worship that god. They're all gods. You should worship them all. And so this is a highly tolerant, embracing sort of religion. The state gods were to be worshipped by all people, and if somebody refused to worship the state gods, that could lead to problems for the person. Why not worship the state gods? That would be an act of, it'd be a political act, choosing not to worship the state gods. But the state gods were to be worshipped along with other gods, who were to be worshipped as tradition required and as people wished. Intolerance within religion was reserved, by and large, only for immoral or socially disruptive forms of worship. And so that's what pagan religions were basically like. Many gods worshipped according to ancient traditions, usually involving prayer and sacrifices in temples with priests, a highly tolerant set of religions. As we'll see later in this course, Christianity came along as a major exception. It was quite different, especially in its emphasis on doctrine and on ethics, and its intolerant religion of its intolerant relationship to other religions, because Christians maintained that they were right, and since they were right, everyone else was wrong, something that pagans didn't claim for themselves. Within the ancient world, of course, there was not only pagan religions, there was also Judaism. Judaism stood out as unique in the context of the Greco-Roman world before Christianity appeared on the scene. Jews made up a small portion of the Roman Empire, possibly something like 7% at the beginnings of Christianity, 7% of the empire. Generally, it's thought that there were something like 60 million people in the Roman Empire at this time, and so there might be something like 4 million Jews at the empire. The Jews were located not only in Palestine, but throughout the entire Mediterranean. The Jewish religion was like other religions in several ways. As these pagan religions that I've spelled out for you, Jews also stressed prayer and sacrifice to God at specific times and places on set occasions. These prayers, these acts of sacrifice, were performed in order to secure divine favor, so that God would look kindly upon his people, and also to protect against divine wrath. And so in many ways, the Jewish religion was like other religions. It too had a temple, the temple in Jerusalem. Sacrifices were performed there, prayers were performed there, etc. In other ways, though, Judaism was very distinct within the pagan context of the Roman world in several ways. First, Jews insisted on worshiping only one God. This made them unusual in the Roman world, where everybody else believed in the multiplicity of gods. Jews worshipped only one God. That's not to say that the Jews believed in only one God. It is to say that Jews believed you should worship only one God. There's good evidence that at different periods of history, Jews, in fact, believed that there are a multiple of gods. You can find this even within the Jewish Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, what Christians call the Old Testament, within the Ten Commandments. You shall have no other gods before me, says the Ten Commandments. Well, you need to think about that for a second. Well, no other gods before me. That presupposes that there are other gods. It's just they're not to be worshipped before the God of Israel. At that point in the life of Israel, in fact, Jews weren't saying there is only one God. They were saying there's only one God to be worshipped. That's the difference between what's called henotheism and monotheism. Henotheism is the idea that you're only to worship one God. Monotheism is the belief that there is only one God. Some Jews were henotheists, some were monotheists. In any event, all Jews agreed that there's only one God to be worshipped, the God of Israel, who is understood to be distinctively the God who had chosen the Jewish people to be his own people. Jews had ancient traditions that they had written down in which this selection of them as the chosen people was, this selection was set forth. Jews had scriptures. This made them somewhat unusual in the ancient world. The other religions, the other pagan religions, didn't have scriptural authorities for their perspectives. Jews, though, did have scripture, especially books that now we might talk of as the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. In particular, at the time of Jesus, the first five books, the Torah, which means law, the law of the Jews in the first five books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. These books show forth the traditions of Israel and show forth how God chose Israel to be his people. The term the Jews used in order to explain the special relationship they had with this one God was the term covenant. The Jewish people believed that God had made a covenant with them, his people. The covenant was, the term covenant, by the way, is a legal term, which just means an agreement. The agreement, the legal agreement that they had was that God would be their God who would protect and defend them in exchange for their devotion to him. That was the agreement. God chose this people to be his people, and in exchange, they do the things that he asks, as set forth in the law, the Torah. This law, then, taught the children of Israel how to worship this God and how to live together in community. Those are the major overriding points of the Torah: how to worship God in ways appropriate to him and how to live together in community. I should stress something that many Christians have not understood over the years, that this law of God, this Torah, was not thought of by Jews as being a horrendous burden that they had to follow, and that if they couldn't follow it, then they were going to pay the consequences by going to hell. This was not a religion that thought that you have to follow all these laws or God will judge you and then you'll be have to pay an eternal price. The Jewish law was not seen as a burden. The Jewish law was seen as a great gift. The one God who created the world has chosen us as his people and has given us his law that we can follow. There's nothing particularly burdensome about this Jewish law. It includes things like you shouldn't murder one another. You shouldn't take somebody else's spouse. You shouldn't bear false witness in court. These are not overly difficult rules to follow. They included not just ethical rules, but they also included things that made Jews distinctive as a people. There were certain food laws. Jews should not eat shellfish, shouldn't eat pork. There are certain other ritual laws. You shouldn't work on the Sabbath. That wasn't seen as a big burden. That meant one day out of the week, you got a vacation. Nobody else had this. You don't have to work 7 days. You get a day off. This was seen as a great good by Jews because this is God's giving his guidance to his people. The Jewish law, then, was seen as the way that Jews kept up their part of the covenantal bargain. Ethics were a larger part of Jewish religion than pagan religion because ethics were embodied in this law. And so Jews understood that there was only one God to be worshipped who had made a covenant with his people Israel. The law was part of that covenant. It was to be followed so that Jews could stay within this right relationship with God. We should not think that ancient Judaism was a monolith. Judaism in the time of Jesus was in fact quite diverse, as diverse as Christianity itself was going to become. There were some Jews who emphasized that what God really wanted was for people to adhere properly to the temple cult in Jerusalem, where the sacrifices are to be performed. And so they emphasized the sacrificial aspects of the Jewish religion. There were other Jews who stressed the importance of keeping the Jewish laws as fully as possible within their daily lives, so that the laws that God gives in the Torah are to be followed down to the very detail. There are some Jews who emphasize that rather than emphasizing the temple cult. There are some Jews who emphasize the importance of maintaining purity before God, who thought that what really mattered to God wasn't just kind of keeping the laws or following the temple cult, but keeping personal purity before God. And so some Jews went off into monastic-like communities to maintain their own purity apart from the contaminating influences of society. There were other Jews who insisted, as the central aspect of the religion, on the coming intervention of God to overthrow the forces of evil in the world. These were apocalyptic Jews who maintained that God was soon going to intervene once and for all for his people and overthrow the forces of evil. Jesus himself was born in the Roman world into a Jewish home. If we're to understand the beginnings of Christianity, we need to understand the kind of Judaism that Jesus himself embraced and to see how his teachings then came to be developed after his death by his Jewish followers. That will be the subject of the following lecture.